Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of You're Wrong with David Harsanyi and Molly Hemingway. Let me just get this out of the way. If anyone wants to write the show, they should email us at radio@thefederalist.com. I always forget to include that, and we love mail, right, Molly?
We love mail. I think we should mention it again at the end because our listeners are the best, and they have funny emails and smart ideas. So,
all right. There you go. I will. If I remember, I will mention it at the end.
Okay.
So this week, I think we should start with reviewing something that happened last week, the big House fight over the speakership, which I think both you and I thought was way overblown and way overdone as a sort of a media, a political story. You would have thought that it was, you know, the end of Congress, that something like this would destroy the Republicans. In the end, I think it was, you know, I just think it wasn't as climactic an end as I had hoped. You seem to think that it was much more exciting than I do.
So first off,
as far as how it ended,
I was talking to Guy Benson yesterday on his radio show, and he played this clip of Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes, just like losing her mind. This, by the way, was after it had all been resolved and Speaker McCarthy was named or elected and all that. She said this was not just a horrific embarrassment to the Republican Party, but the very nation as a whole. And just, it was like the worst thing that had ever happened. It was really weird and bizarre. Leslie Stahl is maybe best known for when she lied in an interview before the 2020 election with Donald Trump, where she claimed that the Hunter Biden laptop showing the Biden family business dealings was a hoax or had been debunked. Totally not true. She's never apologized for that. But she kind of matched the tone of a lot of people in the press. It was just horrible. And I actually thought it turned out pretty much couldn't have turned out better.
Well, let me quickly say, I mean, it is really confusing. It's hard to understand why anyone can make the case that it's embarrassing for democracy to have a party not lockstep in choosing their speaker, or not lockstep in any other way, right? I mean, this is exactly how it should be. Now, obviously, we in the United States form left-right consensus before elections. We don't have to go through this sort of parliamentary anarchy, which I hate, which people think is a good idea in European countries and Israel and places like that. But I mean, having a, what was it? How many days did this go on? 4 days, 3 days?
I mean, three? I don't know.
Yeah, is not really an embarrassment at all. And in fact, in most European countries, there are far more drawn out, you know, nutty fights over leadership than this. So I don't think it's an embarrassment at all.
So I remember when Hillary Clinton tweeted that Hungary couldn't reelect its president or else it would be a threat to democracy, that if they voted for the candidate she didn't want, that would be a threat to democracy, which really clarified, if it was ever in doubt, that the left uses the word democracy to mean things we like. And mm-hmm. So I actually do think, according to the left's definition, what happened was a threat to them. So the Republican Party seems to operate best when you can unite the establishment wing and the like America First wing, the more populist, conservative populist wing. And these rules changes enable conservatives to have far more weight on legislation than they've been able to have for many, many years. And so the speaker fight was really a rules fight about whether, you know, whether you should be able to have an amendment process that is in any way meaningful, a very pro-democratic thing, by the way, or whether you should be able to vote on appropriations bills independently and have debates about how we're funding and what we're funding in each given appropriations bill, instead of having these massive omnibus bills that nobody even reads, much less debates, or whether conservatives should be allowed to be on the rules committee and have an actual, you know, important sway there. And so these things are good for the Republican Party. It has a very, very, very narrow majority, which is kind of a problem because it means there's not a lot that they can get done, which can demoralize their base, makes it hard to, you know, build consensus. So I think it really, there was a little bit of a risk that this was all going to go off the rails, and instead it just went really well. Kevin McCarthy is tied to that conservative base now in a way he wasn't before. So it's better than the alternative.
I'm not crazy about some of the things that I saw. For instance, the sort of snap vote on the speakership that I think takes one person to initiate. I feel like it was called Jefferson Motion or something like that.
It was in place for like 200 years. It's not like some radical change.
But it does create, it just makes it more, it makes things more unstable. Again, if there was some other alternative speaker that I thought was going to do a great job, it wouldn't bother me that much. And I do like some of it, but a lot of it won't matter. Having a border plan won't matter if you don't run the other, the other branches. Having a, or even the Senate. I forgot what else was there.
Well, there's this new committee that will look into some
that
of
that I'm a big fan of, yeah. I mean, but was McCarthy opposed to that in the beginning? It seems like that's something they were going to do anyway.
I think you pick up on the fact that I tend to like Kevin McCarthy, given who he is. Like, he's not a conservative. He's not an ideologue. But just the fact that he's willing to be speaker at a time like this means that you got to give him some props. But he has a reputation for agreeing to things, but then not following through. And so whether or not he was going to do the things that he might have said he was going to do is different than having to have a firm agreement.
Is it true that there is no written agreement here and it's just basically his word? I saw a story on that yesterday.
I think there's no formal voted on agreement, which is different than saying there's not like a written agreement. I think they probably wrote it down, but also understanding that these people do have the votes to cause problems if things aren't adhered to.
All right. But the world didn't end. The Republican Party is still intact.
I hope Leslie Stahl's doing okay, though. I really do.
Okay. Another story that was of interest to both of us was this piece. And actually, there are two pieces like this. I saw another one in The Atlantic. Basically, it takes Ron DeSantis to task for not basically going along and participating in mainstream media in the way that Republicans have for forever. And, you know, it starts with blaming Donald Trump for changing everything, for taking, needling the media to an art form, to Ron DeSantis, who apparently does not give interviews to like the New York Times and things like that. And Peter Baker, a big reporter, I think at the Post or the New York Times? He might be at the Washington Post. I forget.
No, isn't he at the Times?
The Times. Okay. He said, you know, he tweeted this out and then basically he said that, you know, it's basically a shame that Ron DeSantis won't speak to the nonpartisan media and only focuses on conservative media. One thing I want to just preface this by saying that I think they have Donald Trump wrong, right? I mean, he actually, I think, to some extent, craves acceptance from the mainstream media. He's constantly speaking to people he probably shouldn't be speaking to in the mainstream media, including at the New York Times, who have quoted him correctly probably many times, but also distorted what he says and what he wants many times. And he keeps doing that and has done that his whole career. So I don't think that Donald Trump has taken, maybe Ron DeSantis will take it to a new place. But I think that other than publicly bashing the media, I don't think Donald Trump behind the scenes is exactly the guy they make him out to be when it comes to mainstream media.
Maybe we can just take a step back here and think about how for literally decades, the right has complained about how corporate media has been biased against conservatives, sometimes horrifically so. And this has been an ongoing talking point from Republican politicians going back literally to Dwight Eisenhower. You know, and then George H.W. Bush he always said his favorite campaign reelection bumper sticker was annoy the media, reelect Bush. I read Bill Barr's book where he still blames the media for George H.W. Bush's failure to win re-election. And it just becomes like an increasingly big issue. Donald Trump absolutely changed the game by going to war against the media, doing it so well, I should say. Because Newt Gingrich, you might recall, in the 2012 primary, I remember talking to a National Review person who was very confused at why people liked Newt Gingrich. And I, being like the embodiment of the normie conservative or whatever, I was like, oh, I'm all in on this. Like when Newt Gingrich questioned the assumptions of some stupid question he was asked in a debate, I was like, that guy gets it.
That was the first time I can remember a presidential candidate or someone on that level running taking that kind of tone with the media. People have disagreed with the media, but the tone he took with them was
utter disdain.
It was quite dramatic, but now that's the tone tons of people take. And obviously Donald Trump has taken to a new level.
Well, and so Trump does this, and he does it with a degree of difficulty. You know how in the Olympics you judge like how well someone does something, but also the degree of difficulty? He was doing it in an environment unseen prior to him. So I don't want to take away from that, even if, as you know, he talks to reporters he shouldn't talk to all the freaking time. Oh, sorry. I was going to stop saying that. I was going to stop even whatever you call those words that aren't actual cuss words. So I'm working on that and I'm going to not do that. So I mean, I'll continue, but I'll try not to do it. So he talks to people he shouldn't. He would give stories to people he shouldn't, but he was clearly like the most transparent and accessible president we've ever had. Like, you know what, you could put everybody else together and he was still more transparent and accessible. He was like running a commentary about the interior thoughts of his mind publicly. You know, reporters have never had it so easy, but they were too stupid to figure it out. So I don't think you get a Ron DeSantis without Donald Trump in many ways. I mean, you don't get Ron DeSantis elected without a Donald Trump. You don't get Ron DeSantis behaving the way he does without a Donald Trump. So I want to take away from that. But Ron DeSantis does it so much better because he just ignores the propaganda press. He does not deal with them. They have shown themselves without fail to be propagandists whose sole like desire in life is to destroy Republican voters. And so he just doesn't play that game, which is what every single Republican elected official should be doing. And it is kind of hilarious to see the New York Times and the Atlantic going after him. Although I have to be honest that I don't read them anymore. I'm like the Ron DeSantis news consumer. I just don't pay attention to them unless I have to. So I didn't actually see what they had to say.
So I'm told if you look up Emily Jasinski in the dictionary, the words relentless skeptic come up as a synonym. Seriously, I am skeptical of absolutely everything, including investments. What am I talking about? Well, let's take crypto. Crypto seemed a little fishy to me since all I heard about was people becoming millionaires overnight. I personally prefer tangible investments like real estate, silver, and gold. So I did a little research and found out about another tangible asset top investors are falling in love with. Everyday Americans can now invest in a massive multi-trillion dollar asset class that's historically been limited to the ultra wealthy. I'm talking about high-end art. You might be wondering, why would anyone invest in art? Since I'm so freaking skeptical, I was thinking the same thing. But when you realize that contemporary art prices outpaced gold, real estate, and the S&P 500 returns by nearly two times from 1995 to 2021, it's easy to understand why. Now, if you want to invest in multi-million dollar art, all you have to do is log on to Masterworks.com. They're the investment platform worth over $1 billion that lets people invest in art. They've securitized over $600 million worth of art. They realized net returns of 11%, 14%, and 18% for their investors from their last three offerings. In fact, one member has made over $65,000 from his investments in Masterworks offerings. With numbers like that in this economy, I can understand why over 605,000 members have signed up. And with stocks coming down from sky-high valuations, demand to join the platform is higher than ever. Luckily, I've partnered with Masterworks to get VIP passes to skip right to the front. To secure your spot, head to masterworks.art/federalist. That's masterworks.art/federalist. See important disclosures at masterworks.com/CD.
My take on this is probably a little different. Like, I have no problem with Ron DeSantis ignoring these publications, not giving them interviews. That's fine. I don't know that it really matters that much. Even if he did, I'm not sure it would hurt him. Actually, I don't think it would hurt him, but I think it could help him in the sense that he is incredible when he takes on, like, the best moments that I remember of Ron DeSantis are during press conferences when people challenge him, a reporter challenges him. He is so fluent in, the topics that he talks about. He's disciplined, and he, unlike Donald Trump, you know, which those press conferences were amazing and a lot of fun, but he was not exactly disciplined in how he spoke. And I don't think there's anything wrong with giving interviews to a you know, antagonistic outlets, as long as you make sure you tape those interviews yourself so they don't distort what you're saying. And I think it could be beneficial. Yesterday, what's his name? Byron Donalds was on Joy Reid's show on MSNBC, and they got into it. And she looked like an insane person, which she is. And he came off really well. And I think that if you're confident and you're principled and you know what you're going to say and you're not worried about being caught in any kind of gotcha because you're a principled politician, it shouldn't be a big problem for you to take on those interviews. The problem for me has always been, since I was reporting news in Denver, is that Democrats rip the media all the time, but then Republicans rip the media all the time, but then they go to media and leak them every single important story. They will never give big stories to conservative media. It's very difficult for reporters and conservative media to get them to say anything. And that, you know, that's the real problem, where they think
that the job of a conservative or non-leftist reporter is to not criticize them.
Exactly. Like they would, I'd always get these these emails of how surprised they were that, you know, I won't give names, whatever, in Colorado, for instance, where people would be angry at me for criticizing them. Like I'm supposed to be part of their team. But, you know, maybe reporters wouldn't be as antagonistic towards the establishment if they actually weren't giant hypocrites and leak them some stories and help them out, more. I mean, this is just the reality of the world. You have left wingers and you have right wingers in general. There are very few not unbiased reports. And by the way, you know, we've gone far beyond bias. Bias used to be the case with corporate media. Now it's activism. So that's a big problem. But
that's why I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that you think that DeSantis should play along with the corrupt propaganda press. I think that when you engage with liars and malicious people, it makes you sort of one of them, unless you are really engaged in combat the whole way. And there is nothing redeeming about the corrupt propaganda press at this point. They delight in their lies. They take no responsibility. I mean, they're doing what they take the responsibility, which is they think their job is to run smear operations, whether it's the Kavanaugh hoax or the Russia collusion hoax or any other hoax that they get involved in every single day. And that the way to make them lose their power is not to give them the credit of giving them an interview so you can yell at them. Although that is certainly better than what most Republicans do, which is eagerly hope to get with the New York Times to be able to tell them their story. And this time it's really going to work. I mean, that is so embarrassing. No offense, but Republicans who do that are such losers. It makes me feel just disgust and disdain for them. They're so craven. Oh, on that note, I saw Ben Sasse, who I love for real, even though I know he's frustrating to a lot of Republicans. He was saying how he felt so bad for Donald Trump, that he was so needy, but that he really did appreciate that he stood strong on judges. And I was like, no politician gets to talk about another politician being needy and seeking approval. It's absolutely true that Donald Trump is one of them and does. He is not unique in this. But anyway, I digress.
Problem with that, though, is what, you know, that if you allow these giant, these corporate media outlets have a big reach, and it's not just in pure numbers, but sort of filters down, you know, the news filters down and they get to define who you are. I think a lot of people hate Ron DeSantis in blue states, have never actually heard him talk or give an interview. They just think he's this nut. And I just think he's impressive in those interviews. Like, listen, this sounds self-aggrandizing, but I mean, are you scared to... I'm not scared to talk to anyone because I know what I believe. I have no problem talking about it. They can't make me say anything I don't want to say. And I just don't think there's a big problem with giving interviews to people who are antagonistic. In fact, sometimes those interviews are more revealing than having interviews where someone's just sort of patting you on the head.
I do get asked for interviews from corrupt propaganda press agents all the time, and I don't respond because my time is worth so much more than to appear with a possibly okay quote in a New York Times piece that overall destroys the conservative movement. One time I did play along with them years ago. I can't even remember what the topic was, but they got something just completely wrong. So technically, the quote was accurate, but they got the context completely wrong. So the fact checker goes with me. I think this was the New York Times. And I'm like explaining to this idiot fact checker that they got it wrong. And they were like, no, we got you on tape saying these exact words. And I'm like, right. But like the way you presented them was completely wrong. Or I might remind you, when Devin Nunes used to get hit pieces on him in the New York Times or other publications, I would call up the people that they quoted and be like, did they quote you accurately? And I still remember this guy in the Central Valley of California was like, well, technically I did say that I didn't want to hear from him ever again. But I told it as part of a story about how I went from being an opponent of his to being his campaign's biggest supporter. So yeah, they technically quote you accurately in order to just completely lie. And I just don't want to play that game. It's a waste of my time. I would so much rather be debunking their false stories and doing real journalism rather than acting like they have. I mean, I'm sure they want to talk to me. I would rather do anything else.
No, I like to debate people. And I'm not saying you
unlike
have to
me, clearly.
Yeah, David. I'm not saying you have to engage in, you know, and show up for everything they ask you to do. But I just don't think a wide ranging interview for Ron DeSantis with some antagonistic outlet is that bad of an idea, because I think he's actually quite good at it.
He'll have to do it. And to support your larger point, one thing I was realizing as we're talking about like Republicans taking the House and Democrats having the Senate and the presidency, the biggest threat to the Republic remains our corrupt propaganda press, who lie with abandon every single day, and they are destroying the country. They do not tell the truth about anything, any story, big or small. They lie. They maliciously lie. They go out of their way to hurt people. They are a massive problem because so much, even though people claim they don't believe the corrupt propaganda press anymore, they do. They still can set the agenda. They still can like make people talk about the things they want to talk about or move things in the direction they want to. And so everyone who cares about this country needs to take them on more and more.
The problem also is that to do real journalism, to do big stories, you need time and you need a lot of money sometimes, because you know, when I worked at the Denver Post, there was a desk with two reporters that would work on one story for an entire year. And there's a good chance that those stories sometimes will fall through, and not every, you know, it's, there's just no way that smaller publications can do it. So we have to rely on the bigger publications, and then we either have to debunk what they're saying or really look deeper to see what the story is about, which is a perfect segue to this story of Joe Biden and his quote unquote think tank where classified documents were found. Now, it was clear to me from the start that this was a preemptive leak to manage the story. And the media literally, and sometimes I mean literally and verbatim, just took what the spokespeople said, because you could see numerous stories, and moved it forward as a news story. So the story is that these people at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement in DC, one of these shops that basically is, you know, is just exists to give people money and to move money around. They had found some classified documents in a box and immediately called the archive, National Archive, and gave it back and so on. And this is the accepted storyline. Now, let me ask you, if this had happened to Trump, would anyone just simply show zero skepticism about this? Would they just not ask questions about why there isn't a raid on this think tank to look for more documents, or talk about what are these documents about? Why did they have them? How did it happen? I don't believe that these things just happen innocently most of the time. You know, I'm skeptical, and I just, again, feel like that's how journalists should be, but they're not.
I love this story. I do, first of all, think that mishandling of classified documents is a big issue. If you are a normal person and you mishandle classified documents, you might go to prison. And when Hillary Clinton unquestionably mishandled classified documents and claimed that she thought the C for classified or whatever was just part of a lettering system, you know, She should have been busted, not just for the mishandling, but for lying, you know, to
it. Can I just quickly interject here that everyone is like, you're such a hypocrite, because I don't think the Trump thing is that big a deal. Doesn't seem like that big a deal. And frankly, this Biden thing doesn't really seem like that big a deal to me either, though there is a distinction, as you mentioned to me, you know, I hadn't thought about it initially, is that presidents can declassify things. Biden had no right to do that as vice president. But here's the thing. Hillary purposely built a server to circumvent these things and then sent. She is guilty by any standard, which is Comey basically admitted. And it's not analogous. She is guilty. She did it preemptively. Can't be a mistake. There was no mistake to it because she initially built that server. Whereas in these cases, these are fights over documents. It's possible they were accidents. It's possible that people thought they were declassified, so on and so on. Anyway, sorry.
Well, I mean, you kind of took what I was getting at too here. Like, sorry. I understand it's an important thing. I wouldn't normally care that much at all about Biden mishandling classified information, except for what the country has been put through by our completely out of control FBI and Department of Justice and National Archives, which have gone to absolute war in a way that was just very poorly thought out. I mean, even if you grant them every single one of their absurd contentions, which I don't, it would be a very bad idea to raid the Mar-a-Lago residence on the grounds of mishandling of presidential paperwork. But to do that with a president who has full declassification authority, which means you better just like, the reason why presidents just get worked with on their paperwork disputes is because of things like their declassification authority and how there's a lot of chaos and misunderstanding. Everything we heard about why this unprecedented raid of a presidential home was necessary has kind of turned out not to be true. You remember the FBI and Department of Justice were leaking to the Washington Post that it was like nuclear codes. And then it was like, oh no, it was actually like a news clipping about nuclear, like everything that was leaked to be for maximum drama turned out not to be true. And then you have someone who was not president, who does not have declassification authority, mishandling classified documents. And they're all like, oh, this is actually different in a way that's less bad. No, absolutely no. Like, I want the White House raided right now. I want every home of every Biden fully raided. I want every vehicle that crackhead was ever in raided in case there are any documents. Like, I want, and I wouldn't care normally, or I wouldn't care that much about it. And then the other thing is, to friendly political allies at CNN, they leak that these documents were about Ukraine and Russia, places that we are now doing a proxy war with and in because of the Biden family business in part. I mean, like, there is no question that the Biden family business, which has been engaged in every corrupt country and with every corrupt oligarch and with the Chinese Communist Party, and we don't know anything, and now all of a sudden documents are found, and they're all, and all of our corrupt press again are like, oh, it's no big deal. I hate this.
I mean, Biden has a long history, not just that personal history that is potentially corrupt, but he has a long history of placating Putin and of doing things in Ukraine that are very suspicious at the very least. So shouldn't we know what are in these documents? No.
The quote unquote think tank where no thinking and no tanking was taking place was funded by the Chinese Communist Party or with one of its affiliated businesses. And nobody's supposed to like, oh, no big deal. We turned over everything for the Trump family, which people knew they had a global real estate business. Nobody knew that the Bidens were raking in money all over the world with the Chinese Communist Party and other entities like that. And every time we get this like interplayer, we're like, "Why, gosh, why are we distracting ourselves in Ukraine and doing this proxy war with Russia that seems to be helping China? Gosh, could it have anything to do with the Biden family getting so much money from China? I don't know."
You know what's great about this story, though? The grappling that the media had to do to talk about the distinctions between the two incidents. Like, one is in his home. Like, this guy at Politico kept saying, one is in an office. think tank, mentions think tank over and over like it matters. And the other one is in a house. Everyone knows what's laying around in their house. Donald Trump's house has like 63 bedrooms. He doesn't know what's laying around his house that any more than someone in a sixth floor shop in DC does. And isn't and his residence has the Secret Service. It's not like someone could just walk in and take classified documents. It's much easier to go into a closet in a think tank and do it. So this was his personal office of Joe Biden, not just some think tank. And
also, there is no think tank.
Yeah, that's
Joe
another
Biden
thing.
Has never had a thought in his entire life. There is no think tank.
What's funny about it is this is a foreign policy think tank, and Joe Biden has literally been wrong on every foreign policy issue since 1973. You know what I mean? Oh, I see. I forget we had this debate one time. In my mind, he's been wrong, or the reasons for why he took positions were wrong. But in any event, they talk about the where. That's, and also, this is just a small amount of stuff. It's not so many papers. Like, it could be that one of these top secret documents, which there are a number, what was it, 10, is far more important than anything that Donald Trump took. It's not a numbers game. That's a ridiculous way to look at it.
Actually,
this.
Beyond that, when I hear leaks to the media about the number of documents, I assume they're inverse. I assume Trump had like 6 and Biden had 4,000. I mean, I don't believe anything. Earlier today, when the White House came out and said that they had ascertained that the grounding of flights by the FAA was not due to a cyber attack, I was like, oh, so it's a cyber attack. Like, I just assume the opposite of what I'm hearing is true because I know how much they lie.
But so they leak it to CNN, right? This story. Let me just read you this. So they go through that he has top secret documents or classified documents and intelligence memos covering Ukraine, Iran, United Kingdom. But the vast majority of items in the office contained personal Biden family documents, including materials for Bo Biden's funeral arrangements and condolence letters.
Oh, like, my gosh. Did Joe Biden write this?
Exactly. Completely irrelevant. I assume most boxes, there were like 3 bylines.
Let's name them and shame them, if you don't mind. Could you name them for me?
Four. It took 4. Jamie Gangle, is that a name? Marshall Cohen, who's terrible. Evan Perez and Paula Reed.
Evan Perez, one of the original Russia hoaxers on the CNN story that got the Russia collusion hoax going. Quality reporter there, buddy. And also, I think he's the one who's really good friends with Fusion GPS, which of course ran the Russia collusion hoax.
Well, listen, I assume most boxes of papers in the Trump family home also relate to Trump family business. It is completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter if he has a billion other files with other things. These are classified documents. And, you know, but this is how they cover it. So it's a complete joke. It's curated to diminish the seriousness of it. It's curated to make these ridiculous. CNN has like an infograph, which is, and one of the things on it was like, gives the number of documents for each. And then it says Trump under investigation for obstruction, Biden, you know, not. Well, yeah, this is the Biden administration. No one's going to prosecute Joe Biden, you know, in his own administration. And that's another thing. Why isn't there a special counsel for this as there is for Trump? They have far more wide ranging, you know, purview. They look into a lot of different things. They're not just looking specifically at one law. Anyway, so it's just the usual. I'm trying to think of a word that is not a curse, but it's just the usual nonsense and the usual double standards. And there's, you know, at some point it gets frustrating because there's nothing you really do about it. I mean, what are you going to do about it except point it out? Not much.
Not going to answer.
Elect people who will do something about it. One quick thing, I just want to go back on the House stuff, that they are going to have this commission, like a church commission, to look into the FBI and other intelligence agencies and stuff like that. And people kind of like poo-poo that one as irrelevant and, you know, undermining the police and thing, you know, and law enforcement, stuff like that. But I suspect there's going to be a ton of stories coming out of that, in the sense that Benghazi had stories completely unrelated that basically brought down Hillary Clinton's presidency, but or helped, right? So I do look forward to that commission.
Presidential campaign, you mean, not presidency?
Yeah, presidential campaign.
Yeah, I saw, speaking of our awful media, someone was pointing out today that the Washington Post, when they wrote up about this church style commission to look into abuses at the Department of Justice, that they said it's unlikely, you know, Democrats are going to participate in this committee, unlike the J6 committee where Kevin McCarthy declined to like put people on the committee. It's like, that is not what happened. Kevin McCarthy put people on the J6 committee. Nancy Pelosi did something that had never been done in the history of the country for people who care about these things and lack of precedent. She kicked off the two top Republicans, including the ranking member, Jim Banks, you know, an Iraq war veteran, I think, very distinguished person. And then also Jim Jordan, the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. She removed them. And at that point, Republicans said, well, we're not going to take part in a completely fraudulent committee. And at that point, the media should have reflected that this was a uniparty committee. Nancy Pelosi hand-selected everyone, including the two so-called Republicans, Liz Cheney and crying Adam Kinzinger. And they treated it like it was a bipartisan committee when every single member had been appointed by a Democrat. And that is not a bipartisan committee.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that McCarthy has already removed or is removing Ilhan Omar, Adam Schiff, Eric Swalwell. How do you pronounce the name? Swalwell? I never have said it, I think. So those three, and then, you know, for vengeance, basically, right? Which is
well,
fine.
Actually, I think the only one that's vengeance would be Ilhan Omar, because the Republicans that were removed from committees were removed, like, they removed Marjorie Taylor Greene for committees for things she had said, not done, said, that were actually also in dispute before she was elected a member of Congress. It was ridiculous. And likewise, Ilhan Omar, I think, is being removed for things she's said. Eric Swalwell and Adam Schiff, that is a completely different situation. Adam Schiff really abused the country and Congress by lying for years about, he claimed he had personally seen evidence of collusion with Russia from Trump. That was a lie, a bald-faced, awful lie that for which there really should be some kind of criminal prosecution if possible.
Yeah, he's
did
one
it
of the
from
most
his
corrupt,
perch right. as the top Democrat on the House Intelligence right. Committee. And so that really just destroys Congress and the integrity of Congress. You know, that's just
he's almost surely behind a lot of those Russiagate stories, Russia collusion stories and all that. And, you know, yeah,
he also remember his office was the one that coordinated with the so-called whistleblower for the first impeachment. So he really has like besmirched Congress. And then Eric Swalwell also.
Wait. And how about Schiff's efforts to censor journalists on Twitter who undermined his, you know, partisan, efforts? So, yeah. I mean.
And Eric Swalwell was sleeping allegedly with a Chinese communist spy. So he shouldn't really be in a position where he's receiving classified information. So I kind of put them differently. But I was curious what you thought about the Ilhan Omar one. Like, do you think why?
I don't think someone who hates America should be on a committee that is tasked with defending the country. I think that it's perfectly reasonable to take her off that committee if this is the road we're going down. And I just, you know, because she's an anti-Semite, I just don't care that much. But honestly, I hope that this is the end of this kind of thing. It's not healthy in the country to have one party dictating all of that. I mean, I do want some debate. I want people of different viewpoints on these committees. It was Nancy Pelosi who did this. There has to be some kind of repercussion. In fact, I don't even think this is the right way to deal with this. Adam Schiff is a different story, but he should be dictating who is on this church committee, right? That would be the real, that would be the same as dealing with the J6 committee, not otherwise.
The equivalent would be if Republicans voted to remove all Democrats from committees, or not equivalent, but that would be sort of like, oh, you want to play this game? And then force the media to call it bipartisan when there are no Democrats on any committees. But yes, I think the equivalent.
No, but the problem is that you can't even find Democrats who are like Liz Cheney.
Oh, right.
Like you're not going to be able to find anyone who would participate probably, right?
Yeah, I don't know. The Republican Party seems to uniquely harvest Liz Cheney types.
It's a diverse coalition. Mm. Well, now she is gone.
Feel good story of 2022.
I was hoping you would do another impression, but it didn't happen. One of your beloved impressions. I think that's all.
I want to also just quickly talk about the gas stove propaganda thing.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Because you wrote about this.
I did. The name of my column, the title of my column is Why Won't Democrats Protect Us from Stoves That Want to Murder Us in Our Sleep? And the basic gist of the story is that all of a sudden, I'd never even heard of this. And on Monday or Tuesday, a bunch of Democrats were out there, progressives, telling us that gas stoves not only kill Americans, but they specifically kill minorities, which is amazing that gases can do this. And that if we don't ban them, we're basically racists and so on. Now, I'm not talking about just some like AOC outlier, even though she's a big part of it. But I'm talking about Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, on and on and on. And so the idea was floated by the what's that stupid thing called? The Consumer Product Safety Commission, a completely unconstitutional institution that is just a shadow government that has no real oversight, that they were going to ban gas stoves. And of course, the reaction was pretty bad. So then what happens is today, they say they're not going to do it, which means that all these people went out on a limb talking about how it kills everyone are, you know, what happens now? Why are Democrats allowing people to die from gas stoves? I just don't understand it. Anyway, my main point here is in the piece is that there's two underlying problems here. The first is that Democrats have no limiting principles. If they could ban you from doing something tomorrow and there wasn't some big public pushback, they would do it in a moment. They would not care. If they could take your car away, they would. If they could stop you from speaking a certain way, they would. And the second one is this is nothing to do with your health. This is just another environmental thing. They want to get rid of gas stoves, and they want everyone to go electric because they think in the future we're going to have solar panel, you know, grid powered grids and wind grids and all this not fantasy world of theirs that they live in, and which would be a huge mistake. And we already see it happening in places like California, I think. So anyway, that's just my basic takeaway on that.
Okay, I have a few thoughts. One is that I have lived in a house with an electric stove for 5+ years. And when we bought this house, our first home, it was the one thing that really bothered me about the house was that there was no gas stove, because I really prefer to cook on a gas stove and I like to cook, and it's just been hard. But because I don't know how this was for you when you bought your first house, like 30 years ago or whatever it was for you, but you know how like you can't really afford anything other than your first mortgage payment.
Yeah.
You know, and then, or you like, you're putting everything into the down payment, then you pay your mortgage and it like,
your house poor. Yeah. Your house.
And then and then it gets easier after a while. So I literally had just made arrangements with a contractor on Monday to bring the gas line over to the kitchen so that we can put in a gas stove. And I care deeply about this topic.
So I've owned a number of houses because I've moved around as a journalist, and only one of them, I believe, had an electric stove, and we hated it. You know, gas stoves give you much more precision when you're cooking, or at least I'm told, because everything I make tastes like, you know, I make pasta, so that's pretty easy. But in general, it is much easier to use. I like to let the gas really flow out and then light it so that there's this big, you know, explosion, you know, and I would hate for someone to take that away from me. But I get what you're saying on a personal level, but people should be able to make that choice. It's pretty clear. Gas stoves are not any more dangerous. By the way, studies show that electric stoves are far likelier to cause house fires than gas stoves. So
we have ourselves almost caught the house on fire multiple times because
How about dryers? Dryers, I think, are one of the leading ways that people have house fires. And, you know, they're often
David, if they're listening to us, they're going to ban both electric and gas stoves. OK, but I wanted to make a point about the thing you were talking about the way people like all adopt a talking point and they just run with it. And I was talking with a smart guy this weekend about how Twitter is the means of propaganda in our society. And it's very insidious because people participate in it themselves and they think they have some sort of control over it, when really they're just being fed a bunch of like hysteria or bad information. And, you know, that's what to me is so interesting about the Twitter files showing the government's involvement in this propaganda operation. And we really should be careful because of how our sense that we control this somehow makes us less immune to the propaganda.
Yeah. I mean, Charles Cook at Nash Review pointed out that AOC was lecturing everyone yesterday. She literally had never even typed the word stove in a tweet before yesterday. But yesterday she was talking to everyone like, how could you not want to ban stoves? They're killing us. You know, it's like, and then it had like 90,000, 100,000 likes. All these brain dead lockstepping numbskulls just are liking it. And all they probably never even thought about this 1 second in their lives before then.
Or as I think John Hassan pointed out on Twitter, he took that comment from her and then he took a picture of the stove that is always featured in her TikToks. And it's a gas stove.
Anyway. So is that it as far as politics goes? Okay. I wanted to actually bring something up. I didn't mention this in our 2 minute pre-show meeting.
We do a lot of prep for this, and I think it shows.
No, I think living is our prep. Living our lives is our prep. You had mocked me on our private chat when I mocked the young people we work with. We're talking about how great it would be to have drive-in movie theaters. And drive-in movie theaters, in my mind, were one of the worst and dumbest things that people came up with whenever they, you know, came up with. And they were dying out when I was young already. Apparently they still exist, and I put them, and here's my list of things that sound good that people theoretically talk about that are terrible. Drive-ins, hot tubs, breakfast in bed, and massages from, you know, strangers. Those things are theoretically things we should like, but are awful. Drive-ins were terrible. You couldn't hear the movie. You couldn't watch the movie. Usually you'd have to open your window to put that little speaker in, and it would just be the heat would come in or the cold or whatever. And everyone with their lights, it was just terrible. And they're talking about the movie Grease. In the movie Grease, John Travolta sexually assaults Olivia Newton-John in that scene. He does. Tries to rape her in the movie.
Okay, so first of all, I think we've talked before about how you're not supposed to share what I put in the private chat.
I feel like this is innocuous enough.
Brazenly. But yeah, Samuel Mangold Lennett and Sean Fleetwood were talking about how they really would like to experience a drive-through. And then you were like, drive-throughs are horrible and they're totally lame and you can't listen to movies or whatever. And I was just pointing out drive-throughs are not for listening to like every line of dialogue in a, you know, French cinema. It's for hanging out with friends, maybe making out in a car, and that's why they're awesome. And it's probably not good that they've gone by the wayside.
When I go to see Blade Runner at a drive-in, I want to hear what's going on. I'm not there to do any of those other things. We could talk later. We could make out later. You know, anyway, I was a teenage boy. That didn't happen very often for me. But, you know, anyway, I'm happy they're gone. So I wanted to mention that.
Okay.
Let's talk about something else now. So we often talk about the movies and the shows we watch, and you and I said, I have not watched any movies that I can remember this week. And I did, but we'll talk about that after. And you said, I want to talk about why we don't watch movies anymore. Why you don't watch movies anymore. Do I have that right?
No. I'm just saying, sorry. I haven't watched anything since we last chatted, but the reason why was because we had this like really active weekend and we had multiple parties. It was Epiphany. First of all, my family was out of town. Then it was Epiphany. So we have special church services. And then something that rarely happens at my congregation, because we're a very oddly young congregation, we had two deaths of older ladies. And so there were preparations for that. And anyway, I just like haven't had time to watch anything. But I did go to a bunch of parties, and at every single party, people weighed in like extremely excitedly on Mark Hemingway's piece last week about how he hates it when people back into parking spaces at the grocery store. And I'm talking like federal judges and really high level people were like, I want to talk to you about that piece. And they either totally agreed or totally disagreed. And it just cracked me up because I was pretty neutral on it.
I love how you go to Washington cocktail parties with federal judges. I'm a man of the people. Anyway, I loved that piece. I all of a sudden, like a few years ago, I noticed everyone backing into spots. It takes them like a million years to do it. I have to get into wherever I'm going. I don't need an 80-year-old taking 25 minutes to back in. I think it's easier to back out and leave than to back in. It takes more coordination to back into a spot between two cars than it does to leave a spot with two cars. That's just what I think. And I just pull in and I hate the people back in. But apparently, I think a kid told me that that's actually like part of the driving tests in some states now. I don't know if that's true. But yeah, I love that piece and I'm happy that people have weighed in. I saw a ton of comments on it. And when I tweeted it out, you know, people don't read the story. There's like, what are you running out of things to write about? And I'm like, I wish I wrote that piece. And I think that piece is more important than almost anything I've written in years.
It definitely, yeah. It caused a lot of debate. I love that. You have to actually hone your debate skills and tolerance for different viewpoints. So it's good. But I was surprised at both the level of agreement and disagreement with that. Because I'm one of these people, like, I tend to pull in, but occasionally I back in depending on the circumstances.
I don't think I've ever backed in my life. Maybe when I return rental cars, because that's how they are, and I want to be courteous to the next person. But other than that, no. We had a slew. So when we started out at the, you know, with the Federalist, and we were both there day one, you know, we had this sort of Federalist-y pieces that were a little bit off, you know, opinionated, but a little bit counterintuitive or, you know, off center. And we had three or four of them this week about, like, one was, and I think Jordan Boyd wrote it about how leaving shopping carts in the, it's like only insane people leave shopping carts in the middle of, what was that one?
Amen. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there was another one and I can't remember what it was, but I was very happy to see.
There's Eddie talking about how you should treat walking like you treat driving, which I agree with. Like, I can't believe people just, they're so selfish. I think they just walk as if they're the only people in the world. So if they stop and turn around, you know, they don't think about how there's like a whole flow behind you.
Also, how about stay to the right? Like, what is happening? People just don't know. Like, if you're on an escalator, move to the right. Now, I used to live in, you know, New York, and I'd, you know, I'd want to kill the tourists in Midtown who were all, you know, don't know how to walk in public. So anyway, those three pieces I thought were all amazing, and I was happy to see them. I did see a movie. It just hit me.
What?
I don't know how to read it. It's the actor's name. Jake Gyllenhaal. Is that how you say it?
Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal. Okay. He was in a movie called The Guilty, which I didn't think would be good on Netflix, but it was quite interesting. And it's based on a Danish movie. He's a 9/11 operator. And it all happens like in one room. And it was really good. Oh, and I saw another movie. That was really good. It was with Bill, not I'm so bad with names. Bill Knightley, the guy who was in.
Oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about.
The English guy. Yeah. It was a movie called. Oh, man. Give me 1 second. It's about his missing son. It's called Sometimes, Always, Never. And it's kind of about Scrabble, the game Scrabble as well. It's just this quirky English movie. And I think it was on Amazon, but I really enjoyed it. Yeah. And last but not least, one of our great readers sent us, recommended a show, and a British show that I like quite a bit. And it's called, and I've watched it, but he recommends it. It's called Line of Duty. And I think it's on like its sixth season. And it has like every season has some actor you'd recognize, some British actor you'd recognize co-starring. And it's a procedural drama, police procedural drama.
I'm totally going to check that out.
It's very good. I thought the first season was the best, but they're all really interesting and the acting's fantastic. So,
okay. Did you ever see The Bodyguard, the British?
You've mentioned it numerous times and I've wanted to watch it, but it seemed a little too
soap opera-y
and sort of about just their affair than the kind of things I want to watch. Now, I'm not against that sort of stuff.
I wish Mrs. Harsanyi would watch it and then I could find out if she liked it.
I will pass that along.
But I think Mr. Hemingway liked it.
Oh, he did. Okay. I don't know. He's badmouthed some of my choices. So now I'm like, I'm less inclined to want to give in to his choices. His writing's fantastic, but I'm not sure I'm going to give in on the TV choices.
Oh, this is so unimportant, David, but I did do a puzzle, you know, over Christmas, and it's this great like nativity scene. It's a very challenging puzzle. When I got it all put together, there were three pieces missing. What should I do? Should I throw out the puzzle or what?
You're asking the wrong person. I have people in my family, they love doing the puzzles, and I just don't understand the appeal of it in any way. It's just frustrating and stupid. And once you're done, what are you supposed to do? Let's say you had all the pieces. What are you going to do with it? Glue it and put it up on your wall?
No, I've done the puzzle usually over Christmas. I feel like last year one piece was missing and now three pieces are missing. So,
do you know that there are insane people who do monochromatic puzzles, like just of one color?
I do get a point in the puzzling where I just separate each puzzle piece by type. You know, does it have four outies or four innies? You know, and then I just kind of like go through them. So I could probably do monochromatic puzzling, but it doesn't sound very great.
It was one of the things on the list of things that I would try as I get old, like walking or bird watching. You know, I've been doing more of that and like monochromatic puzzles, walking as exercise, not just as a means of transporting yourself from A to B, and other things that I do, like fishing. One thing I will never do is golfing, which I hate. The passion of a thousand suns.
Yeah, I wish I could golf.
Heat of a thousand suns.
I can't.
Really? All right. Well, that's it for this.
I think we've finished.
Sometimes I gotta be honest. Like,
nobody's
sometimes
listening at this point. It's just you and me talking about puzzling and why we don't go.
Sometimes I forget that we're on this. We're taping this for actual people, and I'm embarrassed after that. I'm so ridiculous.
I know. I feel badly. Okay, let's all whoever's made it this far. Let's all keep this our secret. That this evolved.
But mail us at radio@thefederalist.com and be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.